This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. And today we have a very special guest. Her name is Lionel Shriver. She's a pretty great writer, and her new book is called Big Brother. It's got a belt on the cover. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. It's funny because I've got this book in my hand, and I'm not sure whether the cover on the side of the book, Big Brother's upside down. Is that intentional?
I don't think so.
Because I think I must have gotten one that was...
You must have got a freak copy.
I do. I have a freak... And you never... Because this book is funny at times, isn't it? Wouldn't you say?
I should hope so. I mean, the topic is literally heavy. So it has a couple of elements, and it deliberately included to leaven the tone.
And that's why I thought maybe my cover's deliberate. But Big Brother's upside down, so I think I just got... And this copy could be worth a lot of money someday.
I bet.
I'll have to send it to you to sign
it. Especially if I sign it.
Exactly. Imagine it'll be worth millions.
I'll sign it upside down.
There you go. That's good to see you have such a good sense of humor. You really are a terrific writer. My friend has been telling me about you for a while. She reads all your books, and I thought, I'm going to finally read this one because it sounds interesting.
I'll tell your friend thanks.
Yeah, she's just a big, big fan of yours, and you really know how to make a scene electric. I mean, there are scenes in this book that really come alive. I mean, and I'm just sitting there holding the book thinking, oh, I love this scene. I don't even want it to end.
Well, but then you get to the next one.
That's right, and then there's another one.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there's such interesting characters. It almost feels like these are real people. It's amazing. Did you know people like this?
I think we all know people like this. After all, it's a book that is about, among other things, people's relationship to food. And lately, we all seem to have a pretty intense relationship, and also a rather complex one.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm interested in the way we use food in our relationships, and also in our relationship with ourselves.
Mm.
And I'm a little mystified how it has become so complicated. Why it's a rarity now that you have somebody who eats when they're hungry and quits when they're full.
Mm-hmm.
But that seems to be a Paleolithic man at this point.
If only I got full. It seems like I never get full. I mean, I'm not a fat guy, really. But I don't think I ever get full. That's the weird thing. I think maybe my stomach must be huge or something. I don't know. I mean, food, I mean...
Well, maybe lucky you. I mean, one of the theories that the novel puts forward is that being sated is unpleasant.
Hmm. There's a lot of things this book puts forth, things I'd never thought about before, which I found interesting. I like when you read a book and it makes you think. I mean, you think, what would it be like if I was 386 pounds? I mean, what would I feel like? I mean, what would the world be like?
I think it's exhausting, among other things.
Yeah, I mean, I can't...
It's just a lot of weight to carry around.
Yeah, and you know, and I see people, I mean, working in a bookstore like I did, I saw a lot of big people. I mean, I always think to myself, well, what does that feel like? And, you know, I instantly feel sorry for them because I know it's a burden to be 300 pounds.
It also must make you self-conscious in public because, after all, we've all got our weaknesses, right?
Mm-hmm.
But someone who's very heavy wears his weakness on his sleeve.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a way in which that's not fair. You know, if you're mean with money and you walk down the street, nobody knows it.
That's true.
Unless you ask them for a dollar.
That's right. It's amazing how quickly people can think you're cheap. You know, if you say no right away, they think you're cheap. You know, we make these harsh judgments about people that may not be true, you know?
Well, we certainly make harsh judgments about people based on what they weigh. And that's one of the things I wanted to look at,
right?
The kind of assumptions we make about people's characters when not only they're very fat, but if they're super thin.
Right.
And some of the assumptions we make about the super thin are not very pleasant either.
I'm reading this book and I'm thinking, oh, I can't wait to talk to the author. Maybe I should ask her if she has a weight problem or if she has a food problem. Saying, well, no, that's rude. You can't ask people that. You know, you can't ask a woman.
That just shows you're not British.
Oh, really?
Sorry, but British journalists wouldn't blink an eye before asking me in detail, you know, what I eat every day and what my exercise regime is.
And they did? Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's they're the nosiest journalists in the world.
Is that right? Maybe I'm a little...
I would certainly not characterize myself as having a weight problem.
You don't look... In your picture, it doesn't look like you do, but you can't.
However,
always...
you know, like anybody, there was a short period of time that when I was much younger that I did experience gaining some weight, and I hated it. And most of all, I hated getting rid of it. I mean, that dieting is horrible.
I mean, you know, we think about eating today, and I mean, a lot of people eat because they're bored, or there's just not a lot to do, you know, but when you think about what there is to do in life, there's always something you can be doing. I mean, you can be cleaning, you can be taking a walk, you can run around the block, you can, I mean, there's thousands of things to do, but why do people eat? I mean, it's so pleasurable. I guess that's the bottom line. It feels good while you're doing it.
It has its own engine, partly because, I mean, this is what I propose. It's very hard to hold the pleasure. It's a fleeting pleasure, and a lot of the enjoyment of eating is looking forward to it and remembering it.
Right.
So, the moment of the food in your mouth, it doesn't last very long.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I think we lost you just for a second there. Yeah, you're right. It doesn't last all that long, but it is. Unless you have a big pile of it in front of you. Maybe it does.
Well, I think that food is capable of delivering only so much pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not that I don't like food. I love food. I love to cook. But we're expecting too much of it. And therefore, when we keep going to it to satisfy us, and it doesn't satisfy us, we keep going back to it. I mean, there's a way in which it becomes more addictive because it's not delivering.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get halfway through the bag of cheese with doodles, and you're not satisfied, and you're going to finish the bag. And it's partly because if you're eating for the wrong reasons, then you're going to keep eating because whatever aimless unhappiness you're suffering, you know, a kind of boredom or disgruntlement or whatever it is bugging you or making you feel a little empty, a little needy, the cheese doodles are not going to do it for you.
Right.
If you're not physically hungry, if that's not the problem.
Right. It's a fascinating subject. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It's fascinating to talk about. And I love the character's name, Edison. I mean, he sounds like a big guy. Edison sounds like it just has that sound of a bigger type guy. Is that why you use the name?
I use the name because I love that name. I actually came across it in a signing queue. Someone gave me their book to sign to Edison, and I said, "That's your name?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "I'm going to steal that."
Well, what made you write about this subject? I mean, was there a reason you wrote about this subject now? Or had you been thinking about it?
Yeah. I mean, I lost my own older brother in 2009 to the complications of morbid obesity.
Oh.
And so it's hit my own family pretty hard. And I mean, I hope I didn't just write out of therapy. But,
yeah.
And I didn't start the novel until someone after my brother died. But I thought, you know, since it was a personal concern to me, but it was also a large social issue, so it wasn't merely my family's problem, then it was a pretty good material for a book.
Well, what did your family think of it? I mean, when they read it, what did they think? I mean, they obviously knew why you were writing it.
They seemed to like it. Nobody's taken offense. In fact, if anything, I think they're a little offended. They're not offended.
No, oh, really?
That's right. Well, you know, families love to scrap. and there's nothing to fight over in this book. I mean, it is not autobiographical. It is not about my real brother, and it is not about my real family.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
I think they were a little hurt not to find themselves in it.
Oh, I see. They wanted to be part of the book.
Exactly.
Like, they wanted to be able to pick up the book and say, here, this is me. Isn't this great? She wrote about
right.
me. She's talking about me. There's that little thing of fame we all want to experience, of something that we've done that's famous. Like we can tell somebody, I was on TV, or I was, you know, and I think that feels good to a lot of people, even though, you know, we wouldn't want to be in the spotlight every minute, you know. I think maybe there's that. I mean, I know with me, I love to be the center of attention every once in a while. Not all the time, but, you know, you don't want too much of a focus on you. Do you feel the same way?
Let me assure you that fiction writers find that if they don't include their nearest and dearest in the book, you know, there's like, where am I? Am I not important to you? But if you do include them, then you're really screwed.
You have to be careful what you say too.
Yeah, so you know, you can't win.
You obviously have some major talent. I mean, I know you're not going to say, you may not say yourself that you do, but you obviously do. Just reading this book, I can see the major talent that's there. I mean, you're an author.
That's kind of you to say.
It's true, and you're an author. I can't wait to see what they're going to write about next. And were you always this good at writing?
You know, I like to think that I've improved over the years, but I decided that I wanted to write when I was 7 years old.
Seven. So what did you write at 7 years old?
Really, really bad short stories.
I'd like to hear one.
No, you wouldn't.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I won a prize in second grade for writing about the renovation of our school cafeteria. And as a matter of fact, I would go from the age of 8 to the age of, I think it's 48, before I won another prize.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I can't understand why you, I mean, you really have some, I mean, this, what makes a book so good to me is the characters seeming real, and all of these characters seem real. I mean, you bring them all to life. It's like they're all three-dimensional, and that's so important with a book. I mean, I read a lot of books where I don't feel like I know the characters.
Uh-huh.
I may like the writing, but I feel like I don't know who these characters are. They're not real enough to me. They're just plastic characters.
Yeah, I know the sensation you're talking about, that you know, Carol could be anybody.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like it's a stick figure being walked through paces. I mean, I'm sometimes admired and criticized for the fact that I make my characters less than perfectly likable.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see that there's any choice. I mean, I don't want you to hate my characters necessarily, but they have, you know, all the people in my books have something wrong with them, and to me that just makes them like regular people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see why anyone would want to read a book about perfect people. I mean, it sounds dull and flat and unrealistic.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm fascinated by people's flaws, and I also find that, you know, it's strangely difficult to disentangle what's wrong with people and what makes them lovable.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that, you know, there are lots of things about my husband that drive me insane.
What?
But I don't think...
Uh-oh.
Oh, I've disillusioned him.
I don't think he realized that until just this moment.
That's my big surprise. But I, this is a secret that I shouldn't let him in on, but I don't think I'd want him any other way.
Hmm.
Do you understand?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
The same things that drive me nuts are also endearing and make him who he is, and I don't want him to be different.
Well, you look at people, you say you work with somebody who's really strange and makes strange comments and does strange things. When that person is no longer around, you miss them. You miss that. I mean, unless they really, totally drive you crazy.
And therefore, if they're replaced with someone who is... totally efficient and has no quirks, and you have no problems with.
Mm-hmm.
It's dull.
Now, right? You wrote a book that was turned into a movie, the one about Kevin, right? What was the name of it?
We Need to Talk About Kevin.
Now, I started to watch that movie. I have to admit, I haven't watched the whole movie. For some reason, I never got back to it. I want to go back. Somebody told me how really wonderful it really was. Did it stay true to your book?
I would say tonally it's remarkably true, and they were pretty good about not making up very many scenes.
Mm-hmm.
They've added a, you know, two or three bits and pieces, but for the most part, it's faithful. And I think the general feeling that the film ends on is quite true to the book.
Do you ever meet people and then decide you're going to write a book about that person or something that strikes you about that person?
I occasionally make a note of something, maybe not the whole person, but something about them that I think would contribute interestingly to a character.
Right. Then that's the thing that makes you such a good writer. You write such interesting characters. Like I said before, your characters are always, there's always something about them. And, you know, Pandora is this, you know, she's strong. She's a strong woman, but she's not a strong woman. And, you know, she's not, is she the best wife, or isn't she a good wife, you know?
And, well, she's torn. I mean, she's trying to be a good sister and a good wife, and it's,
she's trying to be everything.
Circumstances to be this, be both.
And this company that she owns, I love it. I love the company that the dolls that make, you know,
the monotonous.
Yeah, the monotonous dolls. I mean, I'm laughing just thinking about the dolls. I mean, I'd love to see one. Do those things really exist?
No, they don't. In fact, I mean, I should explain. It's a pull string doll business, which makes pull string dolls for adults, and they're custom made. So the customers send in a photograph of what's known at the company as the victim, and a set of pet phrases that this person uses over and over again. And this product takes off and becomes a national fad.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was credible. And
absolutely,
because it's a way of, it's affectionate. It's a way of providing affectionate ribbing to someone you care about.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see how people would want one. And they're quite expensive, so that it becomes a toy of the affluent and a status item. But before I put this company in the book, I made sure that someone wasn't ahead of me. And I went online and I looked quite thoroughly for pull string dolls. And I did not find anyone who was making them.
Hmm.
But I did find several people who wanted one.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well,
which
you
was interesting.
Maybe
so it was like I found the market, not, and so I provided the product. I've had several people, ask whether I patented it, and can they have the idea? So actually, yes, you may have the idea. It's going begging.
I should mention,
I'm not going into the pull string doll business.
Right. I thought maybe it already existed when you wrote about it. I thought, man, I wonder if she knows somebody has this business, you know. And you can't help but think that when a writer writes about something, right away you think it's autobiographical. And, you know, every writer will tell you there's some autobiographical stuff in every one of their books. Is that true for you?
Tiny bits and pieces, but it's usually a single detail or something.
But it's no fun if we don't know which ones they are, though, is it?
Well,
when we went,
I don't want you to lose any sleep over what is and isn't so-called true. The book as a whole has to ring true in fictional terms, and that's really all you should care about.
Right, but I guess everybody has a curiosity. I mean, I'm sure you have a curiosity. Don't all writers have curiosity?
No, I don't.
You're not curious?
I don't actually care.
I don't care
about other authors and what their little stories are and to what degree they got this from their own families. It doesn't matter a whit to me. I'd rather not know. All I care about is whether the book works in its own terms.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no curiosity about other authors, and, you know, unless they're my best friend. Then it's personally interesting to me. But if they are not a part of my life on a personal level, then
that's an interesting way to look at it.
I don't want to know anything about their real lives.
Are you ever curious about celebrities?
No.
So we would never catch you reading the National Enquirer on the side then.
Oh, I like the stories about their extraterrestrials. As for real celebrities, no. No, I don't understand that curiosity at all.
That's great. I mean, I didn't plan on talking about this, but it's fascinating what you have to say. I mean, I should mention the book is from HarperCollins, by the way. I think I forgot to mention that at the outset.
It's my editor thanks you.
Yes. I mean, there is something about this book. I'm wondering how you know when a story rings. I mean, have you ever written a book and then realized it didn't work?
Well, I've certainly written parts of books that didn't work, and that's what editing is all about. You know, what you read is not the first draft.
Well, how do you know? You just know because you've been writing so long?
The same way that you know when you read something and you're dissatisfied and it doesn't seem persuasive. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem as if it really happened. The character is doing something that character wouldn't do or saying something that character wouldn't say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's writers are readers too, even of their own work. And a lot of the editing process is trying to achieve an artificial innocence of the first reader.
But is it always you that knows it, or can you give the book to somebody, like say your husband, and have him tell you what works and what doesn't work?
When I have a book ready to submit, then I have my husband read it, and he will sometimes call my attention to something. And otherwise, you know, that an editor's job is also to say, you know, this is not working, or this is boring, or this character's undeveloped.
Mm-hmm.
This kid would never say that. You know, like that. And sometimes the editor is right, and sometimes not. That's up to the author to determine.
Right, exactly. Now, Edison's very outspoken, and that's what I like about him. We just never know what he's going to say in this book, and what comes out of his mouth is sometimes it's humorous and yet sometimes horrifying.
Well, I mean, he's intentionally annoying. Mm-hmm. He's one of these people who never shuts up. And of a particularly frustrating sort, and I've met them before. They talk ceaselessly, but they don't really give you very much, at least internal information. It's often external information.
Mm-hmm.
Edison talks about jazz. And he's constantly putting forward theories about jazz or talking about anecdotes to do with famous jazz musicians. But this is not what the people in his surround actually want to hear about. And furthermore, he's not providing any real emotional information. You know, he never says anything about what he feels. And therefore, all this talk is a kind of broadcast, and rather than trying to truly reach out and communicate with people, he's keeping them at bay. And I've encountered this all over the place before. It's often the very people who talk all the time who actually communicate the least.
Hmm. Interesting.
And they use talk to not talk.
Why are we? I mean, I guess one of the questions that I ask myself as I'm reading this book is why are people so horrified by overweight people? I mean, by obese people. Why are we so scared to talk to them? Or I guess we're afraid to say the wrong thing. Or I mean, what is it about? Why can't we accept?
I think you're right that we're afraid to say the wrong thing. It because it's such an obvious, if you will, elephant in the room.
Yes.
When we're talking to someone, especially a stranger, let's say they're not, we don't know them. We're sitting there thinking, oh my God, you're so fat.
Right, but we can't say that.
But you can't say that, and it creates this dissonance, which is uncomfortable. This sense of avoiding something obvious. But at the same time, we know that we can't, you know, say, can we talk about why you're so heavy? Or you're not supposed to mention it or allude to it in any way. And that's difficult.
It's like skating on thin ice, you know. Any moment, bam, you hit the...
Besides which, I've begun to wonder if there isn't an element of that phenomenon, about especially heterosexual men in relation to gay men.
Mm-hmm.
And that cliche about how straight men are always afraid they're gay, and that's why they're so homophobic.
Right. Oh, yeah.
There's an element of we're afraid we're going to get fat, or there's a fat person in ourselves waiting to get out, or this is our fat future, or...
Do we feel the same way about cancer, too? We're around somebody who has cancer, we're afraid we're going to get it, too?
Yeah, there's almost a fear of contagion, even though it's completely irrational.
Right, and yet, and that's sad to think about. Who wants to think about the fact that we would ever be like that? That people would act. But I think you're right. I think there are a lot of people like that, and it's just a sad. I mean, there are moments in this book where we really feel bad for Edison, and yet.
Well, I think people can be horribly cruel about obese people, and it seems to be one of the last sources of bullying that we think is permissible. Mm-hmm. And I don't find it permissible.
I used to have a friend who, when we went to the movie, she had to have two seats to herself. Mm-hmm. Now, I wouldn't say she was morbidly obese, but she was overweight. And yet, I used to think, well, you know, why can't you sit with us? And, you know, but she had to have her own two seats. And, you know, I understand that, but, you know, at some point, I think we want to accept them as people like us. And they are, but, and somehow in our minds, we don't equate that. I mean, sometimes we equate ourselves better because we're not fat.
Well, that's one of the things I take on in the book, is the false moral equivalences we make between weight and goodness, and therefore also moral weakness.
But yet, look at...
You know, if we're thin, then yes, maybe we're in better health, but I'm not convinced that that makes us more virtuous.
And then you look at the whole thing about Santa Claus. Everybody wants Santa Claus to be really fat. I mean, nobody calls Santa Claus fat. They expect him to be fat. And, you know, but he's never criticized for it.
No, but he's an icon from an earlier era.
Yeah.
I wonder if we were designing Santa Claus today, if he would be quite so roly-poly.
he'd probably be a lot skinnier now, but that skinny Santa Claus?
Probably have a six-pack.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we can't even imagine Santa Claus skinny. It just doesn't comprehend. I mean, in your brain, you just can't comprehend that for some reason. But that's what makes your book so good, because they make you think. This book makes me think an awful lot about different things, you know, about how I treat others, about what the way I should treat others. And do you like that? Do you like making people think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I hope I'm not too didactic. There are some reflective passages in the novel, but I make sure that they don't go on long enough that you get impatient. We always get back to the story. I think the story should be paramount. But yes, I mean, I like reading novels myself that make me think or put a different angle on something. I mean, I read a book recently about an abortion doctor, and I'm pro-choice myself.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's about a woman who performs these surgeries and is herself pro-choice, and suddenly experiences of a sense of paralysis and is obviously having emotional difficulties because of what she does for a living. And it didn't change my politics entirely,
mm-hmm.
but it did change the way I thought about abortion, and I acknowledged to myself that, yes, that might be an emotionally difficult thing to do for a living. It tinkered with my head a little in what I suspect is a permanent way, and I admire that.
You know, it's interesting with books. I mean, I would say I'm a little bit overweight, so I guess reading this book, it makes me a little sensitive. I think, well, that could be me. I could just eat and gain 100 pounds. And believe me, reading this book, I got very hungry reading this book.
You know, it's funny you should say that, because especially when I started writing the second section of the novel, which is when the brother and sister end up going on an all liquid diet,
mm-hmm.
It had the same effect on me. I mean, I'd get to the next paragraph, and instead of writing it, I would find myself downstairs staring into the refrigerator.
Oh, really?
It's so weird. And I got wildly hungry.
So what would give me some examples of the things you would eat?
Well, I have certain restrictions on what I'm allowed to snack on, so I'd end up eating the leftover broccoli.
Oh, there you go. Nothing wrong with that. I mean,
great.
Nobody's going to die from eating broccoli, are they?
That'll send you right back up to the next paragraph.
I'll never think the same way about chocolate cake after reading this book. That's for sure. I mean, that's vivid.
I have to say that there's a scene that near the end of the book that does not encourage you to eat chocolate cake.
Ever again. I mean, and that scene is going to stay in my head probably till the day I die. I mean, as soon as I think about this book, that's the scene I'm going to remember probably the most. I mean, it's such a vivid memory from the book, and I'm sure it was supposed to be. I'm sure you meant that to be that way.
It was meant to be vivid.
And you're very perceptive. I like that. I mean, I everything in this book has a meaning, and you know. And the scenes that I, like I said before, the scenes that go on that are so electric, that are so, oh yeah, go get them, tell them off now, you know. And you're sort of cheering on the characters. It sounds kind of sadistic, but I found myself saying, yeah, I want to see what happens with this, you know. It's that sense of I can't wait to see what happens next.
Well, I mean, that means that it has some narrative drive. So I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, narrative drive is not easy to do. I mean, believe me, I've read a lot of books where nothing seems to happen, and then all of a sudden, you know, and maybe all of a sudden it does, but there isn't enough of it. I like a lot of that. I mean,
I'm hopeful that this book reads pretty fast. You know, it's not meant to be hopelessly long. You should be able to get through it pretty quickly.
No, it isn't hopeless. Are all your books like this? Do they all have these scenes that make me feel that way? I mean, if I read the other ones, are they going to have scenes like that too?
Well, you'll have to read them to find out.
Oh, really?
It's a subjective matter, but yeah, I certainly use a lot of scenes. I like dialogue. I like events that really seem to happen on the page, moment by moment. You know, that they will be layered with some description and some summary, and getting that balance is always tricky. But the parts of books that I especially like reading are the scenes where, you know, you have people talking to each other and sometimes in conflict and something's happening between them. And that's the best part of fiction for me.
Do you take any abuse because of your name being Lionel?
I don't generally get abuse. I am forced with horrible frequency to explain why my name is Lionel. And that does get a little tiresome, since I changed my name when I was 15.
Right. What name were you born with? Can I ask you that?
Margaret Ann.
Margaret Ann.
And it just didn't suit me, and I wanted something else. And I was a tomboy.
Right. So you like...
Actually, I just heard yesterday from an editor I'm working with at TimeMagazine.com that something like the deputy managing editor's niece, who lives in Brooklyn, has been named after me.
Really?
In other words, another girl in Brooklyn is now called Lionel. I've started a fad.
Well, Lionel's a great name. I mean,
I think it's a great name, but traditionally, of course, it hasn't been for women, and I guess that's changed.
Do you like trains? Of course, you pick up the book and right away you think, oh, this is written by a man. I mean, your mind goes right to that. Like, this is a man writing this book. And then when you open the back cover and you see a woman, you're like, wait a minute, a woman wrote this? You know, and it's interesting how the mind goes that way, you know. And I love women writers. I mean, we used to have people come into the book.
Well, that puts you in a minority as a male reader.
Really?
Yeah,
I was just going to say, I've had some people walk in the store and they'll say, I don't read women writers. I don't read them. And you know,
I know a lot of men feel that quite passionately.
Why do you think that is?
Women have a reputation for writing a kind of book that men think that they don't want to read.
It's
going to be all domestic, and I think that men think it's going to be sentimental.
Emotional. They don't want it to be emotional. I love an emotional book. I love to cry when I'm reading it.
And they think it's not going to have any action in it. You know, nothing is ever going to happen. People are just going to sit around talking about their feelings.
Right.
Right?
Do men really think that? I guess they do. But
yeah, they do.
And I'm the exact opposite. I want an emotional book. I mean, I read Jodi Picoult just to feel emotional. You know?
Well, when you have emotion in the book, it can be the very definition of action.
That's true.
And I try to write books that have plots, mm-hmm. and the books don't all take place in the kitchen. It's true, you're not going to get a lot of car chases.
Right.
And I kill people occasionally, but I don't make a habit of it. So, they're not going to be dropping like flies.
Well, did you know? It makes me want to ask if you knew the ending of it. We can't really talk about the ending of the book. I don't want to spoil anything. But
yeah.
Did you know the ending while you were writing the book?
I knew the ending by the middle of the book.
Okay. That's all we can say because I don't want to give too much away. People are
right. I had one a different ending in mind, and I didn't like it. So by the middle of the book, my dissatisfaction had become nearly hysterical, and I came up with something else.
Is that the way it is in every book you write, or are they all different? I mean, there's some books you know from beginning to end before you write them.
I pretty much know how a book is going to end when I start it.
I
can change my mind if I want.
Right.
But it's a little bit like, getting in a car and knowing where you're going.
Mm-hmm.
Who wants to drive around town in a wandering, aimless fashion?
Mm-hmm.
You want to go to Key Food. Period. That saves a lot of false starts and writing down cul-de-sacs. It's better to know where you're going.
And strangely, reading this book made me want to not eat either. I mean, I thought to myself, well, I eat too much. I got to stop eating now, because I guess because of him eating so much and points in this book, I thought, well, I should stop eating because I'm eating too much. It makes you very self-conscious.
Which is not self-conscious is not good. Mindful is good.
Mindful.
There's nothing wrong with being mindful.
Exactly.
And I mean mindful not like, I have to count my calories. I mean being mindful of what is it that you get out of food. Why do you think you're going to feel better when you finish the ice cream?
Right.
In fact, you usually feel worse. What does it mean that it's really important to me that my kids like my casserole, or they're a little overweight already. Why am I trying to make them clean their plates?
Hmm.
Mindfulness, just an awareness. It doesn't mean that you should become so seized with confusion that you don't know whether to eat your dinner.
Wait, I swear you sound like a psychologist. Were you ever a psychologist?
Well, I think all fiction writers are amateur psychologists.
Oh, really?
But then I'm of the view that we're all amateur psychologists.
Right, but at the same time, from what you said before about not really caring about other people's little whatevers, you wouldn't make a good psychologist, probably. I mean, overall. I mean, would you?
No, I'd probably be terrible. I was just like, get a grip.
I really don't care. I really don't care what your problems are. I mean, it just from what you said before, it made me think that is. I mean, but you're so good at writing. I mean, you're really, really, really excellent at writing, and I would not like to see you do anything else.
Thank you.
I mean,
I guess I'm going to have to get on with another book then.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Oh, what a chore!
Now, how many books have you written now?
11.
11. And is each?
It's not an elegant number. I obviously have to write at least one more to make it an even dozen.
Are you an elegant lady?
I wouldn't describe myself as elegant, no.
Mm-hmm. But most women wouldn't, I wouldn't think. I mean, how many women, if you ask that question?
I think of someone elegant as very well-dressed, at least, and I dress atrociously.
Right. Do you have a lot of author friends?
I have a few. I think it's important not to just hang out with other writers. But I like having two or three people who do the same thing for a living just so we can talk shop.
Right, which is great. I mean, I think it's it is what you think about a lot. You might as well be around people who do the same thing. It looks like on the back you got Jay Courtney Sullivan and Margot Livesey.
Yeah, believe it or not, those people who are quoted on the back, I don't know them.
You don't know?
Everyone assumes with the blurb thing is so corrupt that those are just your best friends. And often the reader is quite correct in that assumption, but unusually this is not the case.
What do you...
Those were just incredibly nice people who gave a blurb to a total stranger.
Very famous people, too. I mean, very famous authors that are well-known right now. What do you want people to come away with after reading this book? I mean, what do you want? I mean, do you have expectations as far as what you want? I mean, as far as what you want people to feel or think or...
Vague expectations, or I would call them hopes. That mindfulness we were talking about, I would like it if there were a little halo effect, both during the reading and after.
Mm-hmm.
I would certainly hope that you come away with more compassion for people who are very heavy and become a little less judgmental about people on the basis of what they weigh.
Mm-hmm.
And start questioning why do we take this so seriously? And ideally, that mindfulness we were talking about translates into more of a sense of proportion in terms of where we place food in our lives. When we have a proportionate attitude toward it, it is the source of pleasure and also social connection, sometimes even a creative achievement, because cooking can be very satisfying. But if we expect too much of it and put it in the center of our lives, it's only going to be the source of torture and dissatisfaction.
You know, it's interesting. I was thinking about this yesterday at work, and when you're busy at work, how you don't get hungry. It's only when you're not busy that that hunger seems to take a hold of you.
Yes, that's well observed.
And I was thinking that yesterday I had some work to do, and it's been really slow at work lately, but I had work to do yesterday, and I thought, all that time I'm doing work, I didn't even think about eating.
Yeah.
Or when we're doing...
We're getting a focus and satisfaction from something else.
Well, it's like reading. When I read, I like to eat while I'm reading, and I'm trying to get away from that, but it's so difficult. When I'm really reading a good book, I'd like to have something to eat. If only I could get rid of that connection between eating and reading, maybe I'd be better off, you know?
I think it's television that's the real... It's so easy to eat in front of TV.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, especially if you're watching something you're really enjoying.
Because it's more passive. I don't tend to eat when I read, but... But the passivity of television makes it attractive to do something more active at the same time, and eating has an element of the active.
And it's like men with football games. Is there actually a man out there who can sit and watch a football game and not eat or drink beer? Is that physically?
No, I don't think so. I think there's a law somewhere.
One has to go with the other. I mean,
right.
You can't even imagine it. I mean, one without the other, forget it. It just won't work. I wonder. There must have been some kind of interest in making this a movie somewhere. Have you heard from anybody about making it a movie?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I've got a little interest. It hasn't been nailed down,
mm-hmm.
but I'm hopeful.
What one wonders, what actor would want to be 386 pounds for the part? I guess. You know?
Well, and that part would also involve getting down to 163.
Mm-hmm.
I think there might be a lot of actors.
Yeah.
What was it? Gwyneth Paltrow who did that?
Oh yeah, Shallow Hal.
Yes. Which I rather enjoyed.
It is a funny movie.
Yeah.
And
she, you know, she allowed herself to be made up to look enormous. So, and I think she must have had a good time with it.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly looks like she did. I mean, it's a movie that if you're going to make it, you're going to have a good time making it. Or what's the point? I mean, if you're not you know, laughing. The movie's supposed to be funny. So.
Well, I think this a film of this book would have to be poignant as well as funny.
I was watching a movie, and I don't know if you've seen this movie called The Guilt Trip with Barbara Streisand that was just out, I guess, about a year ago over the weekend. And this is the first movie that I have watched where I actually started sobbing in the middle of the, at the end of the movie. And I never, ever, ever do that. I don't know if you've seen the movie or not.
I haven't. What's it about?
It's about a Jewish woman and her son who go on a road trip together. And she's really annoying. And they, it is just, I love this movie. I can't say it. When I first saw it.
Tell me the name of it again.
It's called The Guilt Trip.
Huh.
And
good title.
Yeah, it is, and it's one of those movies, when you see the preview, you think, oh no, Barbara Streisand, she can be so annoying at times.
When she's using that fact.
Yeah, and you watch this movie, and this is how I felt, and I can't guarantee you'll feel the same way, but I'm laughing out loud at this movie, and then I'm crying and sobbing at the end, and I never sob during a movie. I mean, as a man, I can say that, and maybe I'm a little embarrassed.
That's a powerful recommendation.
And how many movies do you actually sob when you watch them? I guess some people probably a lot of people did a Ghost, that movie Ghost with Demi Moore, which was so popular back in, I guess it was the 90s. But, you know, emotion is so good. I mean, men always think, I don't want to show emotion, but it's so good to show emotion. I mean, don't we all feel something for a man who cries?
Well, I'm keen on men who cry.
Yeah.
And what? I think feeling emotion through a vehicle like a film or a book is a relief because you get something out of your system without personally having to suffer the events that cause that emotion. It's a it becomes a vehicle
mm-hmm.
for feelings that are in you somewhere, but you know you don't have to have the horrible experiences that are in the film or the book. And I just think I'm addicted to that. That's why I read fiction. That's why I watch movies.
Right. There's a scene, and when you see this movie, I'm sure you're going to see it now, because there's a scene at the very end that so moved me, and that's why I cried. And it just poured out of me. And You'll know the scene when you see it. I'm not going to give it away, because it's too spectacular to ruin. But, you know, some movies, you go into these movies, and even my friend was sitting here watching it with me, and he was as mesmerized. In fact, he was laying on the couch half asleep, and he woke up when he saw this movie. And it's one of those movies you instantly become interested in. You just can't, it just grabs you by the throat and doesn't let go.
Mm.
And the relationship that this woman has with her son is just, it's funny and it's touching and it's, you know, it's back and forth, you know, and it's just wonderful. It's just a wonderful script. I wish I could watch 100 movies like it. You know, and how often do you get to feel that way about a movie?
Well, you've convinced me.
Your husband probably won't like it as much, but
they go hit Netflix.
Yeah, definitely. Well, this has been so much fun to talk to you. I can't wait to read your next book. I really can't. I'm really excited.
Well, then I better get off the phone and get to work.
Yeah, that's right. Will we see another book next year, do you think?
No.
Not next year.
No, because I actually haven't. I've got some evil plans, but I haven't started the next manuscript yet.
I can't wait to see the movie of this book. I mean, that's...
So you're just going to have to settle for the film.
Well, maybe 2 years from now we'll see another book from you?
I hope so.
Oh, I hope so, too. We've been talking to Lionel Shriver. Her book, again, is called Big Brother. It's out from HarperCollins. It's an e-book in all your bookstores online, everywhere. Thank you so much.
Oh, I really enjoyed talking to you, David.
You too. This has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci,